Renee here at Unsupervised Learning, your easy listening podcast for bleeding edge open source tech.
And it just like, basically we're innovating so much in technology. We're not innovating on human behavior. We're just doing the same thing over and over again. Like we are like hiding this. We are being careful about that. We are superficially complimenting each other. We are not being brutally honest. We are sometimes being harmful because it makes us feel good.
Join me for this conversation with Ritendra Data, currently head of applied AI at Databricks. Formerly director of engineering at Meta, we spoke about burnout, mentorship, the Gen Z mentality, robot motion planning, and directing your own film. It's a conversation that spans a lot of topics and one that I hope you'll enjoy.
I generally kind of put in an introduction that's a lot more succinct at the end, but I had a little spiel saying that you've had like a pretty remarkable journey from Google to Facebook to Databricks, and you're now doing mentorship as well through, is it Mentor Cruise?
Yeah, Mentor Cruise. Yes. I mean, yeah. That's one. I've mentored many people internal to these companies. Mm-hmm. I've never really like mentored externally. And one of the most common kinds of mentorship, and I already have like, I had 20 signups in 3 days or something. And all of them have most of them have the same theme, which is like, how do I get into AI? So, and these are people who are not in AI. So it's, I think, kind of appropriate for the audience you describe.
I reached out to you because of a post that you made that was around like balancing people being afraid of losing their jobs and then also being excited. So it was like a kind of, I do a lot of professional fence sitting where I'm not doom and gloom, but I'm also kind of excited about opportunities, right? And I think it was, what was it? Culture of code.
Yep.
Yeah, culture of code, where you were talking about like mitigating burnout at Facebook and how engineers can do that if they have external pressure. And I thought that was really interesting because I feel like AI is such an external pressure for everybody. But
Good point.
You want to speak to like a little bit about what you're doing at Databricks for applied AI? And is there a non-applied AI?
Yeah, I can. Is the interview started or like how?
This is how I talk.
That's awesome. Okay. So here's the deal. That's always a question I get, like what is applied AI versus non-applied AI? So AI is essentially, you can see AI in two different ways. One is the code and the algorithms that are agnostic to like, what are you using AI for? Because you can see there are many, many different applications of AI. And at Databricks, we do two things. One is we help other companies build AI so that downstream they can build systems that use AI. That's the generative AI world that we live in. And then there is applied AI, which includes generative AI, but it applies to the products that we own and build. So that's different from, like, if we were our own customers and we were using AI to make Databricks better, what would we be doing? That's what I do. That's what my team does. And I'm building out that team. So essentially, one is external facing AI, how to make other companies build AI. And two is applied AI, which is how do you make Databricks itself sort of smarter, faster, better, more efficient, if that made sense. So I think there's maybe three layers for an enterprise software company like Databricks. There are three kinds of software. One kind of software is developer productivity software and like really internal tools, like how do you sort of manage human resources in the company? How do you tax processing, or how do you sort of write code as a Databricks engineer? How do you write code? So that's developer productivity, internal tools. That's not applied AI. And there's not a lot of AI in there. It's mostly like routine stuff. Like, okay, you have a development environment, you DevOps, dev tools, you write code, you build it, you release it. So that's not really, there's not a lot of AI right now in that area. Two is Databricks is a website where it's a portal and you can use it to write SQL like code, and you can run the code and you can build your machines. Now that environment that Databricks is, it's a platform. How do you make that better? Like there's an assistant. If you are like, so let's say Adobe, or if you are Bank of America, or if you are Capital One, you have licenses to use Databricks. And there, when your employees are using Databricks, they may have questions. They ask an assistant, hey, how do I write this thing in Databricks? So that's the applied part. Like, how do you build assistants that other companies use to develop on top of Databricks? Or how do you search? Like, there's also search, right? It's like, so we if you have all of your data in Databricks, then someone needs to be able to search over all that data, right? Any employer Databricks, any employer at Bank of America or Capital One, or you know, those companies should be able to search and find resources that somebody in the company has uploaded or you know, linked to their storage. And so being able to retrieve that information, using that to write, you know, notebooks and, you know, queries and use this as a data warehouse is kind of like, that's all of the applied AI. And the third one is essentially, you don't even know what you're going to use AI for. Because in its most basic form, AI is essentially our ability to like make human-like decisions. But it doesn't, by in and of itself, it doesn't tell you what kind of decisions you're making. Adobe might use Databricks to build certain classifiers for, you know, Photoshop, right? Bank of America might use Databricks' platform to build a classifier for fraud, right? So those things are what I would call the third kind, which is the external applications of AI. So I'm right in the middle, but there's not much AI to the left side. And the right side is also a lot of AI, which is like helping other companies build, because that's what enterprise software does, right? It's a business to business platform.
Shell has a really interesting use case where they're monitoring a bunch of pumps. It was like risk mitigation, wasn't it? Have I got it right? Is it Shell? It's not like some other oil.
It might be Shell. I mean, but it's like, your point is still valid. Like, these large companies have various sensors, like cameras and other types of sensors that are monitoring various things. And instead of having that monitoring require humans look at or observe all that data, you build AI to detect anomalies and then notify the right people and say, hey, go, something is going on over there, go. So suddenly AI, people talk about AI, the recent craze around AI has been around ChatGPT. Like, let's be clear, like ChatGPT caused the biggest jolt to the world in terms of AI. Oh, hey, AI can actually be human-like in what it is able to produce, right? But for the longest time, AI has already been helping all these kinds of use cases, but it's not like the Hollywood version of the AI that we've always seen, like the Matrix, where you're making decisions, you're sort of you know, optimizing for resources. All of that is very action oriented, and that's where generative generation comes from. But Shell monitoring something like this, or some company monitoring gas leaks in some plants, or you know, in the production of some manufacturing at some manufacturing center in America or China, like there is AI that's able to like sort of monitor in various ways, classify in various ways. Like Google's biggest use of machine learning is most likely ads targeting, but people don't think of that as AI. But that is it. Google's neural networks are deciding like which ads you're more likely to click on.
And that's like is it probabilistic? Is that how you say it? Probabilistic system? My biggest question from like a non-technical person is, yes, like how is the AI different from like robotics process automation? Because it feels like it's just like doing a predictive pattern and saying like, so for the use case of like the manufacturing thing that you just spoke about, like how is it different?
I think roughly speaking, the two biggest types of AI are supervised learning, where a lot of historical data allows you to build models that you can then replicate and behave like the historical models. And we've gotten incredibly good at that. When you have lots and lots of data, we just know how to continue in that pattern if the underlying behaviors aren't fundamentally changing, right? Now, generative AI is is a much more advanced version of that, where it's composed of those small decisions, but collectively, it's making bigger decisions. It's doing things that feel like it's generating things. At its heart, it's actually very similar. It's just deciding. Generative AI is just deciding what's the next word for text, right? It's just deciding what's the next word given all the words. So it's also predictive modeling. It's like a robot trying to decide, like, where should I go next? But if you keep doing that over and over again, and as you take steps, you feed that back into the system, now you've carved out a path for yourself. Yeah. Now that path, in the case of a robot, is motion planning. And that path, in the case of text, is a bunch of words being generated that make sense together. The robot might be doing something very smart, like, I don't know if you know about Roomba, right? Roomba is like cleaning the floors. Like, I have a Roomba upstairs. It does its own path planning. It's cleaning up the floor. And it's very general. It's in some sense, and people don't talk about this much, but there's a very clear connection between a robot motion planning and a system that is trying to generate words. Because in both cases, you're trying to accomplish a mission, and it emerges not in parts, but in its totality, right? What you say about Roomba is it was able to find all the interesting parts of my floor and clean them up. It was able to find its way back to its original location. Similarly, like in the case of generative AI, you give it a prompt and it meanders its way through a bunch of words till it gets to a point where the text seems like a complete response to the thing.
Beautiful simile. Like, I've never had someone describe it that way before.
But you were the one who gave me that hint, because I didn't think like that before this, because you said, what's the difference? And I was like, hey, there's not actually much difference, because you sort of figured out that there's a lot of similarity between those two. So I just took your cue and went with it.
I'm going to be honest. I was trying to trick you into saying the definition of unsupervised learning, because I was like, oh, that's a plug for the show.
Unsupervised learning is, as you know, like it's quite, you know, it's where the supervision is just either absent or minimal, and you're trying to like make sense of chaos, right? Like you bring order to chaos, and then there is still a step of supervision that is necessary. Like one classic example, I might be preaching to the choir here, but like unsupervised learning's classic example is, you sort of have a bunch of data, raw data that you got, and then you build clusters of them. And then you suddenly see, oh, wait, there are these seven patterns. Like, for example, if we fed every single interplanetary, like the planetary system's location into a system, it will eventually figure out that there are these galaxies. So no one told it that there are galaxies, but the proximity of various points in that space tells you that this is a cluster, that is a cluster, this is a cluster. Now, there was no supervision because no one taught the system to detect galaxies, but it just detected clusters of points in space. And then a human might come and say, hey, I actually think those are galaxies. So that's like, to me, a classic example of unsupervised learning, although like we don't do this for this kind of application, but we definitely do this for something like image segmentation, where you give the system an image and then it figures out, okay, this is one object, that is one object, and there's not a lot of supervision at least in the older days. Like, image segmentation was typically considered an unsupervised learning problem, where it would just figure out, like, okay, these are all same color, this is your screen is beautiful, like you have this backdrop which looks really nice, there's a purple and there's a blue, so like the algorithm would be like, okay, so those purple pixels, purple dots are like both close to each other physically and also in the color space. So let's group that together. Okay, so that's a classic like unsupervised learning example, but I'll stop there.
That's okay. It sounds like echolocation or like call and response, like, you know, Marco Polo, kind of like, but then imagine playing Marco Polo and being actually blind. So then... have someone like talk it out. That got really dark really quick, but I wanted to talk about you do a lot of evangelism, I feel like, and I read, is it TLDR Zero is the name of your medium?
Correct.
You do a lot of writing and a lot of like I feel like it's not necessarily in the JD for the places you've been, but I feel like that comes from a place of like, I like the knowledge sharing that goes on. But you wrote a post recently that was about the difference between Databricks and other places that you've worked at and how you have a lot more, I can't remember the word you used, but it was like a lot more space to play. Are you finding that, like, what do you like doing?
What do I like doing? Yeah. I like the freedom of doing, building out teams and basically serving a business need with freedom. Like, what I really like to do is be given a rough problem space and build teams that solve those problems. Is good for the business, good for society. Like all of those things line up, and it's actually good for humanity if I used my skills to be able to build a team, and that team in turn built something that was good for both the company, for the world at large. So, and I don't, and the thing I don't like is a lot of supervision. So unsupervised, a lot of unsupervision, like playing on the name of your podcast, is like, I don't like to be told exactly how to go about it. When that happens, I feel very constrained. I feel like when I'm free, like if you look at it, like, I don't know if you saw this movie called Jerry Maguire, Tom Cruise. So Tom Cruise had this, like, in that that character had this thing where Jerry would just wake up in the morning and be like, hey, what are we doing here? Like, this doesn't make sense. I have that exact thing over and over and over again. Like, the reason I write is because I feel like there's a lot of things that people don't talk about openly the way I do. And it just, like, basically we're innovating so much in technology. We're not innovating on human behavior. We're just doing the same thing over and over again. Like, we are like hiding this. We are being careful about that. We are superficially complimenting each other. We are not being brutally honest. We are sometimes being harmful because it makes us feel good. All of those things among human traits have not evolved at all. Like, why is it the case that we are so interested in evolving our technological, like, landscape or whatever you call that, and not interested in evolving the collective human behavior? We're still doing the same thing we're doing for thousands of years. So, like, part of my writing is also, like, I wake up with this thought that I love to challenge status quo. Like, much of my, like, I wake up, like, yesterday I was doing this mentoring, right? Like, I wrote about that yesterday. Half of the people I'm mentoring are so unhappy with their managers. Like, what kind of world do we live in? Of course, this is a biased sample, because people who are unhappy are the ones who are going to seek mentoring. But still, it's not 50%. It's not that 50%. That data means nothing. But what it does mean is that, like, there's at least a sizable number of people, I don't know what that number is, of who have become managers for the wrong reason. So, like, again, that was an epiphany I had that was not, like, why I write, why I work is all driven by just, I'm like doing things and I get these ideas and I jot them down. I have a very, I copiously take notes all the time. I have, like, ways in which I can take, because I keep forgetting. So I keep taking notes and then build on that. When I write because I feel like, and my approach to writing is I have no real reason to write. A lot of people actually told me, don't give away your trade secrets. And this yesterday I was thinking, is that even a real thing? Like, is my behavior, like, is the uniqueness of my behavior a trade secret? Or is, like, should I share or not? Like, a lot of people tell me not to share anything because, you know, it'll mean that someone else will copy it and then it'll, and I don't believe in that philosophy. I feel like life is so short, like, I'll just go away anytime and then all of these thoughts will just die with me. So why not just, like, write it down and then it is digitally immortalized for some period of time. But that's it's a long run answer to your question. But, like, I try to answer both, like, why I do what I do and also why I write. Because I think those are not somewhat related, but not quite. Yeah.
No, it's like a deep, almost like intrinsic motivation. And you mentioned that in the burnout. I don't know if it was like a podcast on burnout, but it was, again, Culture of Code. And it was like, I kept thinking, you're kind of going towards like, it doesn't matter, I can work heaps of hours as long as I'm interested in it. And that really resonated with me because I'm like, yeah, same.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
And you know, like, I think this is this, I'm seeing like young, the newer Gen Z, for example, is much more like that. And I feel like my mentality is also like a bit like Gen Z, even though I'm a millennial, right? But my mentality is like that, where, and I see Gen Z's to be the most, like, I see a lot of millennials, like, they're just trying to follow the rule book, like, you know, grow up, get a good job, like, buy a house and have two kids, like, get married, have two kids, this. Like, I actually think that, like, my mental model is more about, I mean, why should I follow this pattern when there's so little left in this life? So why not just do what I want to do and keep doing it till I just, I'm bored of it, which usually for very interesting things doesn't happen very easily. So it's not like I'm constantly changing my attention, but at least I'm doing the things I like. And when I do that, I think the point I made about burnout, the point I made about burnout, which I think is interesting, and some people say it, not, it's not that well known, but I'm not the one who first said it. A lot of people have said this, which is, burnout is not just a function of hard, like overworking. Burnout is a function of not feeling valued or for not finding meaning in your work. So that's different in a very important way. Like, you could just be burned out and do, like, be sitting all day and feel burned out. Or you could be working all day and not feel burned out. So it's, I think we very easily associate burnout with like a physical or mental activities. But that's not what it is. It's about finding meaning in whatever you do. Even if you did 2 hours of work and you didn't find meaning, like you were at a gas station, like people who are working at a gas station because they don't have a choice, even if they have like 6 hours of work per day, they'll probably be like, what am I doing with my life? And that's a sort of, it's a kind of burnout. But at the same time, like someone, a CEO of a company who has a brilliant idea and is working 16, 17 hours a day for 5 years to build the business will never talk about burnout.
It makes me think of like philosophical kind of questions, yeah. Of being like, there are some people who it might seem like some people are allowed to, I've experienced like boomers and Gen X as being like, oh, you can't just do what you want. You can't just go from job to job. There's like a feeling of you have to do something and put your hours in kind of thing. And going with that intrinsic motivation is almost, it's a real luxury. And it is a luxury because there's a lot of people that can't kind of afford to just go on a whim or as a kind of fancy. It's a complete incomplete thought. I generally ask the same kind of questions every time, saying, who would you interview if you could interview anyone, they can be dead or alive, and what would you invent or claim rights to, can be anything in the world. What's your strongest opinion, work or career wise, and what do you wish people knew more about? But before I get to any of those, I just wanted to ask, like, why are you mentoring?
That's a good question. So I realized that a lot of people are very lost. I'm not kidding you when I say that I have over 7,000 to 8,000 friend, like, connection requests on LinkedIn that I have not been able to go through. And many of them come with these notes which says, I'm disillusioned, I'm lost. I don't have that. I just very quickly glanced through so many friend requests. I'm not able to like help them out because connecting with them doesn't really solve any problem. But I'm getting this learning, this seeing this pattern of like people who are disillusioned by what they're doing, people who are unhappy to various degrees. So I decided like, I think I can bring I've done this before, and I feel like I can bring a lot of clarity to the thought process that people are having. And I'm noticing that it's working because I've seen so many scenarios of these things in companies like this. At Facebook, I had a team of almost 214 at one point, like so many people, they brought their product. I had 4 layers of management under me. And like I had so many people from every, and I didn't have care about the hierarchy. I talked to whoever wanted to talk to me, and many of them had various situations, emotional outbursts, you know, sadness, difficulty, not being able to like cope with the work pressure, not being able to get promoted, so all of those scenarios, I'd seen so many of them. Then I started seeing a pattern that continued to follow me around, And then I was like, what if I just offered that that thought process to some people? What if it just makes them better? It's also an interesting thing that, you know, it pays some money. It's not much money. The money is not the thing, but it's a little bit of money. I plan to donate it. I actually, like, I'm part of a film and theater community which is struggling, like, really badly. Like, no one, like, wants to watch meaningful cinema. A few large corporations are, a few large, like, film production houses are basically, you know, rich gets richer is what's exactly happening. So independent cinema, for example, is almost dying. And I get a lot of requests for people to, you know, sponsor or fund parts of those films. So I decided I'm going to use this way. It works both ways because I don't need the money, but I can use that money to, like, you know, help support, like, independent cinema and some theater as well. So that's my big, I mean, it's a two-pronged thing. So on one hand, it helps people. On the other hand, I make the money. I don't have to use my own personal savings to sponsor these films because these are not investments. Independent cinema doesn't make money. It just goes. Mm-hmm. It's just gone. So it's just art. It'll probably recover some of the costs, but not all of it. It's not an investment. If I were to invest, I would do, like, you know, go to a, you know, buy crypto or whatever. I don't know. So, yeah.
If you weren't doing what you're doing, would you be like a director, an actor? Would you have something
to
do?
No, not an actor. I have nothing. Yeah, I'm not an actor, but I'm very self-conscious on screen. So I don't act, but I direct, I write scripts, I write narrative features. I've written a couple of narrative features, I've directed 9 narrative short films. That's also where, like, are you based out of Australia?
Yeah. Live in Perth.
Okay.
I'm here from Sydney.
I see. Yeah. So a lot of, like, really good filmmakers are coming out of Australia and New Zealand. So anyway, like, that's just something I wanted to say on the side.
Who would you interview? They can be alive or dead. Who would you like to speak to?
This one is interesting. Yeah, I would probably talk to Satyajit Ray, who's an Indian filmmaker. He made amazing movies out of nothing. Like, extremely low budget. Like, he won an Oscar for lifetime achievement eventually. The circumstances under which he created what he did and the budget which he had, it was insane. Like, how do you sort of motivate yourself when you have to create art when you have nothing, right? So it's, like, very interesting. I would ask a lot of questions about how you sort of think, your thought process around, like, how you approach cinema, like, you know, the exact opposite of the AI world that I live in. Like, you know, there's no AI, there's not even, like, electricity. Like, you have to have and there's all, like, that time everything was tape, like films, right? So these massive film rolls, and these are 100-pound machines that, you know, if it fell on someone, they would get injured. That heavy the camera equipment used to be. And, you know, how do you sort of, with so much limitations, how did you bring up so much emotions and like, around the human condition? It was pretty fascinating. Sorry, I wasn't prepared for that question.
No, that's okay.
If you ask me again, I'll probably say something else.
Do you think it is that different, though? Like, do you think that filmmaking and engineering are that different? Because they both go through a process, right? It's almost not a production line. I think if you give an engineer a task to do, they'll kind of do it in a very creative way if you're not. I think artists and engineers are very similar. And I remember someone saying that to me, and I thought they were, like, they'd lost the plot. But yeah. I do agree with it now.
Yeah, I mean, I can speak to that. I actually was thinking of one more thing I was about to write. I'm one of the few people who was intimately associated with both engineering and with co-producing a feature film with sponsoring a couple that got the Sundance Best Short Film Award. And so they're making their first feature film, and I decided to sponsor it. So, like, I actually wanted to write about the commonalities between, like, more generally tech, engineering could be like, I don't know the connection between, say, like a civil engineering, like building bridges. Maybe they are quite similar, but like at least in software, right, where most of my training and experience is quite, there are lots of similarities. And the way I thought about was, instead of talking about similarities and differences, what I could write about is what can we learn from each other. I actually find the filmmaking process to be extremely inefficient. Like movies that they make take $100 million to make or whatever, you can make for like $30 million if you knew the how software engineers optimize things. Likewise, if software people knew, like understood how artists work and how filmmakers work, they would build better products. They just don't. Like Steve Jobs in my mind was like the union of those two. Like Steve Jobs used to love cinema. Steve Jobs was all about aesthetics, and then he was an engineer. So he brought the two together in a way that I don't remember anyone doing since then. Like everyone is inspired by Steve. I'm a huge fan of Steve Jobs. That's another person I would interview if I had an opportunity, because there's a lot of controversy around his life, but specifically around inventing and the clarity of his thought and how he inspired people, I have not seen anyone even close to him. Like, it's one thing to say that you're a marketing genius, but it's like everything he did was not just marketing. There was products that he was thinking, and he had a sense of being, you know, the ordinary person before it was even released. Like, how would you invent the iPad? Inventing the iPad, maybe he didn't invent it, but he definitely had the sense that this is something kids will keep using 20 years from now, because there's something very natural about this form factor and the way in which you can engage, and you know, it will keep getting better even if it's, the initial version isn't great. So there's so much like that intersection of art, cinema, and storytelling and engineering is intricate, and people don't realize that. But what has ended up happening, which makes me a little bit sad, is people who are engineers tend to look down upon soft. Like I've had so many people around me say, oh, that's a soft skill, I don't want you. Who are you serving? You're serving people of all kinds. Like, why would you look down upon your own customers or your own users? Like, I never understood that.
Best place to find you and your work, I'm going to put links and everything, Medium, Substack, LinkedIn, and
like the number one place where you can find me is definitely LinkedIn, because I feel like I've found an audience there that appreciates what I do and what I write, because you know, we are all ultimately humans. Like, I don't want to do something that I don't get appreciation for. Like, I have that vulnerability around just speaking and not being heard. LinkedIn, I've definitely found an audience. So Substack and Medium, it's interesting. Like, the audience is mainly driven by LinkedIn. So like, what I try to do recently is I try to write shorter versions and send them to Substack and Medium. But I'm increasingly starting to think that Substack and Medium, the fact that I'm putting some of that stuff behind a paywall is actually not a great idea. So I'm considering removing all paywall from all of my articles, preventing people from reading my longer form writing just because they don't have a subscription. I'm not convinced that I'm doing the right thing there. So I might be more accessible on Substack and LinkedIn. Sorry, Substack and Medium, because then anyone who goes from LinkedIn to those will be able to see the longer versions of things, and they won't be restricted.
That wraps up this week's episode of Unsupervised Learning. I'm your host, Renee, and I've had a great time chatting with you. As always, links to everything we discussed will be in the show notes. Make sure you reach out to our guests. Questions or feedback, reach out to pod@unsupervisedlearning.co. Until then, leave a like, follow, or rating on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or YouTube. And until next week, stay curious.